It was 3 in the morning. Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs were reaching the conclusion that anyone who intended to invade Ankh-Morpork probably wasn't going to do so now, and there was a good fire back in the watch-house.
"We could leave a note," said Nobby, blowing on his fingers. "You know, come back tomorrow, sort of thing."
He looked up. A solitary horse was walking under the gate arch, a white horse with a sombre, black-clad rider. There was no question of, "Halt, who goes there?" The night watch walked the streets at strange hours, and had become accustomed to seeing things not generally seen by mortal men. Sergeant Colon touched his helmet respectfully.
"Evening, your lordship," he said.
Good evening."
The guards watched the horse walk out of sight.
"Some poor bugger's in for it, then," said Sergeant Colon. "He's dedicated, you got to admit it," said Nobby. "Out all hours, always got time for people."
"Yeah."
The guards stared into the velvety dark. Something not quite right, thought Sergeant Colon.
"What's his first name?" said Nobby.
They stared some more. Then Sergeant Colon, who still hadn't quite been able to put his finger on it, said,
"What do you mean, what's his first name?" "What's his first name?" "He's Death," said the sergeant. "Death? That's his whole name. I mean, what do you mean? You mean, like, Keith Death?"
"Well, why not?
He's just Death, isn't he?"
"No, that's just his job.
What do his friends call him?"
"What do you mean, friends?"
"All right, please yourself.
Let's go and get a hot rum. I think he looks like a Leonard."
Sergeant Colon remembered the voice. That was it, just for a moment there.
"I must be getting old," he said. "For a moment there, I thought he sounded like a Susan."
"I think they saw me," whispered Susan, as the horse rounded a corner.
The Death of Rats poked its head out of her pocket.
"Squeak." "I think we're going to need that raven," said Susan. "I mean, I think I understand you. I just don't know what you're saying."
Binky stopped outside a large house, set back a little from the road. It was a slightly pretentious residence, with more gables and mullions than it should rightly have, and this was a clue to its origins. It was the kind of house built for himself by a rich merchant when he goes respectable and needs to do something with the loot.
"I'm not happy about this," said Susan. "It can't possibly work. I'm human. I have to go to the toilet and things like that. I can't just walk into people's houses and kill them."
"Squeak?"
"Well, all right, not kill, but it's not good manners, however you look at it."
A sign on the door said, "Tradesman to rear entrance."
"Do I count as a..."
"Squeak!"
Susan normally would never have dreamed of asking. She'd always seen herself as a person who went through the front doors of life. The Death of Rats scuttled up the path and through the door.
"Hang on, I can't..."
Susan looked at the wood. She could. Of course she could. More memories crystallized in front of her eyes. After all, it was only wood. It had rot in a few hundred years. By the measure of infinity, it hardly existed at all. On average, considered over the lifetime of the multiverse, most things didn't. She stepped forward. The heavy oak door offered as much resistance as a shadow. Grieving relatives were clustered around the bed, where, almost lost in the pillows, was a wrinkled old man. At the foot of the bed, paying no attention whatsoever to the keening around it, was a large, very fat, ginger cat.
"Squeak!"
Susan looked at the hourglass. The last few grains tumbled through the pinch. The Death of Rats, with exaggerated caution, sneaked up behind the sleeping cat and kicked it hard. The animal awoke, turned, flattened its ears in terror, and leapt off the quilt. The Death of Rats sniggered. One of the mourners, a pinch-faced man, looked up. He peered at the sleeper.
"That's it," he said. "He's gone."
"I thought we were going to be here all day," said the woman next to him, standing up. "Did you see that wretched old cat move? Animals can tell, you know. They've got this sixth sense."
"Well, come on there. I know you're here somewhere," said the corpse.
It sat up. Susan was familiar with the idea of ghosts, but she hadn't expected it to be like this. She hadn't expected the ghosts to be the living. But they were merely pale sketches in the air compared to the old man sitting up in bed. He looked solid enough. but a blue glow outlined him.
107 years, eh? He cackled. I expect I had you worried there for a while. Where are you?
Here, said Susan.
Oh, female, eh? Said the old man. Well, well, well.
He slid off the bed, spectral nightshirt flapping, and was suddenly pulled up short as though he'd reached the end of a chain. This was more or less the case. A thin line of blue light still tethered him to his late habitation. The death of rats jumped up and down on the pillow, making urgent slashing movements with its scythe.
Oh, sorry, said Susan, and sliced.
The blue line snapped with a high-pitched crystalline twang. Around them, sometimes walking through them, were the mourners. Mourning seemed to have stopped now the old man had died. The pinched-faced man was feeling under the mattress.
"Look at 'em," said the old man nastily. "Poor old grandad sob sob sorely missed. We won't see his like again. Where did the old bugger leave his will? That's my youngest son, that is. Well, if you can call a card every Ogswatch night a son. See his wife? Got a smile like a wave on a slop bucket. And she ain't the worst of 'em. Relatives, you can keep 'em. I only stayed alive out of mischief."
A couple of people were exploring under the bed. There was a humorous porcelain clang. The old man capered behind them, making gestures.
"Not a chance," he chortled. "It's in the cat basket. I left all the money to the cat."
Susan looked around. The cat was watching them anxiously from behind the washstand. Susan felt some response was called for.
"That was very kind of you," she said.
"Eh, mangy thing, 13 years of sleeping and crapping and waiting for the next meal to turn up. Never took half an hour's exercise in his big fat life. Up until they find the will, anyway. Then he's going to be the richest, fastest cat in the world."
The voice faded. So did its owner.
"What a dreadful old man," said Susan.
She looked down at the death of rats, who was trying to make faces at the cat.
"What'll happen to him?"
"Squeak!
Oh!"
Behind them, a former mourner tipped a drawer out onto the floor. The cat was beginning to tremble. Susan stepped out through the wall. Clouds curled behind Binky like a wake.
"Well, that wasn't too bad. I mean, no blood or anything, and he was very old and not very nice."
"That's all right, then, is it?"
The raven landed on her shoulder.
"What are you doing here?"
"Rat death here, said I could have a lift. I've got an appointment."
"Squeak!"
The death of rats poked its nose out of the saddlebag.
"Are we a cab service?" said Susan coldly.
The rat shrugged and pushed a lifetimer into her hand. Susan read the name etched on the glass. "Wolf, Wolf son 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 son." "Sounds a bit hublandish to me." The death of rats clambered up Binky's mane and took up station between the horse's ears, tiny robe flapping in the wind. Binky cantered low over a battlefield. It wasn't a major war, just an intertribal scuffle. Nor were there any obvious armies. The fighters seemed to be two groups of individuals, some on horseback who happened coincidentally to be on the same side. Everyone was dressed in the same sort of furs and exciting leatherwear, and Susan was at a loss to know how they told friend from foe. People just seemed to shout a lot and swing huge swords and battle axes at random. On the other hand, anyone you managed to hit instantly became your foe, so it probably all came out all right in the long run. The point was that people were dying, and acts of incredibly stupid heroism were being performed.
"Squeak!"
The death of rats pointed urgently downward.
"G down!"
Binky settled on a small hillock.
Right, said Susan.
She pulled the scythe out of its holster. The blade sprang into life. It wasn't hard to spot the souls of the dead. They were coming off the battlefield arm in arm, friend and hitherto foe alike, laughing and stumbling straight towards her. Susan dismounted and concentrated.
She said, "Anyone here been killed and called Wolf?"
Behind her, the death of rats put its head in its paws.
Hello?
No one took any notice. The warriors trooped past. They were forming a line on the edge of the battlefield and appeared to be waiting for something. She didn't have to do all of them. Albert had tried to explain, but a memory had unfolded anyway. She just had to do some. determined by timing or historical importance, and that meant all the others happened. All she had to do was keep the momentum going. "You've got to be more assertive," said the raven, who had alighted on a rock. "That's the trouble with women in the professions. Not assertive enough." "Why do you want to come here?" she said.
"This is a battlefield, isn't it?" said the raven patiently. "You've got to have ravens afterwards."
Its freewheeling eyes swiveled in its head.
"Carrion regardless, as you might say."
"You mean everyone gets eaten?"
"Part of the miracle of nature," said the raven.
"That's horrible," said Susan. Black birds were already circling in the sky.
"Not really," said the raven. "Horses for courses, you might say."
One side, if that's what you could call it, was fleeing the field of battle with the others in pursuit. The birds started to settle on what was, Susan realized with horror, an early breakfast. Soft bits, sunny side up.
"You'd better go and look for your lad," said the raven. "Otherwise you'll miss his ride."
"What ride?" The eyes orbited again.
"You ever learn mythology?" it said.
"No, Miss Butts says it's just made-up stories with little literary content."
"Oh, dearie me, we can't have that, can we? Ah, well, you soon say, must rush."
The raven leapt into the air.
"I generally try to get a seat near the head."
"What will I?" And then someone started to sing. The voice swooped out of the sky like a sudden wind. It was a rather good mezzo-soprano. And after it, mounted on a horse, almost as fine as Binky, was a woman. Very definitely, a lot of woman. She was as much woman as he could get in one place without getting two women. She was dressed in chainmail, a shiny 46D cup breastplate, and a helmet with horns on it. The assembled dead cheered as the horse cantered in for a landing. There were six other singing horsewomen plunging out of the sky behind it.
"Isn't it always the same?" said the raven, flapping away. "You can wait for hours without seeing one, and then you get seven all at once."
Susan watched in astonishment as each rider picked up a dead warrior and galloped up into the sky again. They disappeared abruptly a few hundred yards up and reappeared again almost instantly for a fresh passenger. Soon there was a busy shuttle service operating. After a minute or two, one of the women trotted her horse over to Susan and pulled a scroll of parchment out of her breastplate. "What ho! Says here, Wolf!" she said, in the brisk voice used by people on horseback when addressing mere pedestrians. "Wolf, the lucky!" I don't know. I don't know which one he is," said Susan helplessly. The helmeted woman leaned forward. There was something rather familiar about her. "Are you new?" "Yes. Well, don't stand there like a big girl's blouse. Jolly well go and fetch him. There's a good sport." Susan looked around wildly and saw him at last. He wasn't very far away. A youngish man, outlined in flickering pale blue, was visible among the fallen. Susan hurried over, scythe at the ready. There was a blue line connecting the warrior to his former body. "Squeak!" shouted the Death of Rats, jumping up and down and making suggestive motions. "Left hand thumb up, right hand bent at the wrist. Give it some welly!" shouted the horned woman. Susan swung the scythe. The line snapped. "What happened?" said Wolf. He looked down. "That's me down there, isn't it?" he said. He turned slowly. "And down there, and over there, and—" He looked at the horned female warrior and brightened up. "By Io," he said, "it's true. Valkyries will carry me off to the Hall of Blind Io, where there is perpetual feasting and drinking." "Don't ask me," said Susan. The Valkyrie reached down and hauled the warrior across her saddle. "Just keep quiet, there's a good chap," she said. She stared thoughtfully at Susan. "Are you a soprano?" she said. "Pardon? Can you sing at all, girl?" "Only we could do with another soprano. Far too many mezzo-sopranos around these days." I'm not very musical, I'm sorry." "Oh, well, just a thought. Must be going." She threw back her head. The mighty breastplate heaved. The horse reared and galloped into the sky. Before it reached the clouds, it shrank to a gleaming pinpoint, which winked. What, said Susan, was all that about? There was a flurry of wings. The raven alighted on the head of the recently departed Wolf. Well, these guys believe that if you die in battle, some big, fat, singing, horned women carry you off to a sort of giant feast hall where you gobble yourself silly for the rest of eternity, said the raven. It belched genteelly. Damn stupid idea, really.
But it just happened.
Still a daft idea. The raven looked around at the stricken battlefield, empty now except for the fallen and the flocks of his fellow ravens. What a waste, he added. I mean, just look at it all. Such a terrible waste.
Yes.
I mean, I'm near bursting, and there's hundreds of them untouched. I think I'll see if I can have a doggy bag.
They're dead bodies.
Right.
What are you eating?
It's all right, said the raven, backing away. There's enough for everyone.
That's disgusting.
Oh, I didn't kill him, it said. Susan gave up.
She looked a lot like Iron Lily, she said, as they walked back to the patient horse. Our gym mistress. Sounded like her, too.
She imagined the warbling Valkyries pounding across the sky.
Get some, warrior, you bunch of fainting blossoms!
Convergent evolution, said the raven. Often happens. I read once where apparently the common octopus has an eye almost exactly the same as the human eyeball.
You were going to say something like, except for the taste, weren't you? Said Susan.
Never crock my mind, said the raven indistinctly.
Sure?
Let go of my great teeth.
Susan released her grip.
This is dreadful, she said. This is what he used to do. There's no element of choice.
Squeak.
But what if they don't deserve to die?
Squeak.
The death of rats contrived to indicate, quite effectively, that in that case they could apply to the universe and point out that they didn't deserve to die, in which case it was up to the universe to say, oh, didn't you? Oh, well, that's all right then. You can go on living. It was a remarkably succinct gesture.
So, my grandfather was death, and he just let nature take its course when he could have done some good. That's stupid.
The death of rats shook its skull.
I mean, was Wolf on the right side? Said Susan.
Hard to say, said the raven. He was a Vazung. The other side were Burgunds. Apparently it all started with a Burgund carrying off a Vazung woman a few hundred years ago. Or it may have been the other way round. Well, the other side invaded their village. There was a bit of a massacre. And then the other ones went to the other village and there was another massacre. After that, you might say, there was some residual bad feeling.
Very well, then, said Susan. Who's next?
Squeak.
The death of rats landed on the saddle. It leaned down and with some effort hauled another hourglass out of the pack. Susan read the label. It said, Imp E. Kalin. Susan had a sensation of falling backwards.
I know this name, she said.
Squeak.
I remember it from somewhere, said Susan. It's important. He's important.
The moon hung over the desert of Klatch like a huge ball of rock. It wasn't much of a desert to be graced by so impressive a moon. It was just part of the belt of deserts growing progressively hotter and drier that surrounded the Great Neff and the dehydrated ocean. And no one would have thought much about it if people very like Mr. Cleet of the Musicians Guild hadn't come along and made maps and put across this part of the desert an innocent little dotted line that marked a border between Klatch and Hersheba. Up until that time, the Dregs, a collection of cheerfully warlike nomadic tribes, had roamed the desert quite freely. Now there was a line. They were some Klatchian Dregs and some Hershebian Dregs, with all the rights due to citizens of both states, particularly the right to pay just as much tax as could be squeezed out of them and be drafted in to fight wars against people they'd never heard of. So as a result of the dotted line, Klatch was now incipiently at war with Hersheba and the Dregs. Hersheba was at war with the Dregs and Klatch, and the Dregs were at war with everyone, including one another, and having considerable fun because the Dreg word for stranger was the same as for target. The fort was one of the legacies of the dotted line. Now it was a dark rectangle on the hot silver sands. From it came what could very accurately be called the strains of an accordion, since someone seemed to want to play a tune, but kept on running into difficulties after a few bars and starting again. Someone knocked on the door. After a while there was a scraping on the other side, and a small hatch opened.
"Yes, Avendi?"
"Is this the Clachian Foreign Legion?"
The face of the little man on the other side of the door went blank.
He said, "you got me there. Hang on a moment."
The hatch shut. There was a whispered discussion on the other side of the door. The hatch opened.
"Yes, it appears we are Clachian Foreign Legion. Yes, yes. What was it you were wanting?"
"I wish to join."
"Join. Join what?"
"The Clachian Foreign Legion."
"Where's that?"
There was some more whispering.
"Ah, right, right. Sorry, yes. Yes, that is us."
The doors swung open. The visitor strode in. A legionary with corporal stripes on his arm walked up to him.
"You'll have to report to..."
His eyes glazed a little.
"You know, big man, three stripes, tip of my tongue a moment ago."
"Sergeant."
"Right," said the corporal with relief. "What's your name, soldier?" "You don't have to say, actually. That's what the
Clachian Foreign Legion?
What it's all about. People join with your mind, you know, when you can't, things that happened,
forget."
"Right.
The man's face went blank.
"Wait a minute, would you?"
He looked down at his sleeve.
"Corporal," he said.
He hesitated, looking worried. Then an idea struck him, and he pulled at the collar of his vest and twisted his neck until he could squint, with considerable difficulty, at the label thus revealed.
"Corporal Medium. Does that sound right?"
"I don't think so."
"Corporal Hand Wash Only?"
Probably not."
"Corporal Cotton?"
"It's a possibility."
Right. Welcome to the
Clachian Foreign Legion."
"Right, right. The pay is $3 a week and all the sand you can eat. I hope you like sand."
"I see you can remember about sand."
"Believe me, you won't ever forget sand," said the corporal bitterly.
"I never do."
"What did you say your name was?"
The stranger remained silent.
"Not that it matters," said Corporal Cotton.
"The Clachian Foreign Legion?"
"Right, right. We give you a new name. You start out afresh."
He beckoned to another man.
Size 15, sir."
"Right. Take this man away and get him,
he snapped his fingers irritably.
Clothes. Everyone wears them. Sand-coloured.
Uniform?"
The corporal blinked. For some inexplicable reason, the word bone kept elbowing its way into the melting, flowing mess that was his consciousness.
"Right," he said. It's a 20-year tour, legionary. I hope you're man enough for it."
"I like it already," said Death.
"I suppose it's legal for me to go into licensed premises," said Susan, as Ankh-Morpork appeared on the horizon again.
"Squeak!"
The city slid under them again. Where there were wider streets and squares, she could make out individual figures. "Huh," she thought, "if only they knew I was up here." And despite everything, she couldn't help feeling superior. All the people down there had to think about were, ground-level things, mundane things. It was like looking down at ants. She'd always known she was different, much more aware of the world, when it was obvious that most people went through it with their eyes shut and their brains set to simmer. It was comforting in a way to know that she was different, the feeling wrapped around her like an overcoat. Binky landed on a greasy jetty. On one side the river sucked at the wooden pilings. Susan slid off the horse, unshipped the scythe, and stepped inside the mended drum. There was a riot going on. The patrons of the drum tended to be democratic in their approach to aggressiveness. They liked to see that everyone got some. So although it was the consensus of the audience that the trio were lousy musicians, and therefore a suitable target, various fights had broken out because people had been hit by badly aimed missiles, or hadn't had a fight all day, or were just trying to reach the door. Susan had no difficulty in spotting Imp E. Killin. He was at the front of the stage, his face a mask of terror. Behind him was a troll with a dwarf trying to hide behind it. She glanced at the hourglass. Just a few more seconds. He was really rather attractive in a dark, curly-haired sort of a way. He looked a little elvish and familiar. She'd felt sorry for Wolf, but at least he was on a battlefield. Imp was on a stage. You didn't expect to die on stage. I'm standing here with a scythe and an hourglass, waiting for someone to die. He's not much older than me, and I'm not supposed to do anything about it. That's silly. And I'm sure I've seen him before. No one actually tried to kill musicians in the drum. Axes were thrown and crossbows fired, in a good-humoured, easy-going way. No one really aimed, even if they were capable of doing so. It was more fun watching people dodge. A big, red-bearded man grinned at Leas and selected a small throwing axe from his bandolier. It was okay to throw axes at trolls. They tended to bounce off. Susan could see it all. It had bounced off and hit Imp. No one's fault, really. Worst things happened at sea. Worst things happened in Ankh-Morpork all the time, often continuously. The man doesn't even mean to kill him. It's so sloppy. That's not how things should go. Someone ought to do something about it. She reached over to grab the axe handle.
Squeak!
Shut up. Whoom! Imp stood like a discus thrower as the cord filled the noisy room. It rang like an iron bar dropped on a library floor at midnight. Echoes bounced back from the corners of the room. Each one bore its own load of harmonics. It was an explosion of sound in the same way that a Hogswatch night rocket explodes, each falling spark exploding again. Imp's fingers caressed the strings, picking out three more chords. The axe thrower lowered his axe. This was music that had not only escaped, but had robbed a bank on the way out. It was music with its sleeves rolled up and its top button undone, raising its hat and grinning and stealing the silver. It was music that went down to the feet by way of the pelvis without paying a call on Mr. Brain. The troll picked up his hammers, looked blankly at his stones, and then began to beat out a rhythm. The dwarf took a deep breath and extracted from the horn a deep, throbbing sound. People drummed their fingers on the edge of the tables. The orang was sitting with a huge, rapt grin on his face, as though he'd swallowed a banana sideways. Susan looked down at the hourglass marked Imp E. Killin. The top bulb was now quite empty of sand, but something blue flickered in there. She felt tiny, pin-like claws scrabble up her back and find purchase on her shoulder. The Death of Rats looked down at the glass.
"Squeak,"
it said quietly. Susan still wasn't good on rat, but she thought she knew uh-oh when she heard it. Imp's fingers danced over the strings, but the sound that came from them was no relative to the tones of harp or lute. The guitar screamed like an angel who had just discovered why it was on the wrong side. Sparks glittered on the strings. Imp himself had his eyes shut and was holding the instrument close to his chest, like a soldier holding a spear at the port. It was hard to know who was playing what. And still the music flooded out. The librarian's hair was standing on end all over his body. The ends crackled. It made you want to kick down walls and ascend the sky on steps of fire. It made you want to pull all the switches and throw all the levers and stick your fingers in the electric socket of the universe to see what happened next. It made you want to paint your bedroom wall black and cover it with posters. Now, various muscles on the librarian's body were twitching with the beat as the music earthed itself through him. There was a small party of wizards in the corner. They were watching the performance with their mouths open, and the beat strode on and crackled from mind to mind, snapping its fingers and curling its lip. live music. Music with rocks in it, running wild. Free at last, it leapt from head to head, crackling in through the ears and heading for the hindbrain. Some were more susceptible than others, closer to the beat.